Hello and welcome to another ramble. Although I'm just going to be honest, today I'm not going to ramble as much. I probably will ramble, but I have a particular point. And I'm going to tell you what that point is after I drink this coffee. I made it loud so you could tell I was doing it. Okay, so I've been having some conversations with just my closest friends, some guys at the church where, we serve. And these guys are like co-founders of the church with me. And so we've been talking about debt and just talking about like, what is the, you know, does the Bible allow it, or does the Bible say we aren't supposed to? Does the Bible call it a sin? You know, stuff like that. And so I told the guys that I would study it. And, cause we all had kind of our own feeling on it, you know, but I told the guys I would study it. I thought, you know, this is a great topic to study and maybe it could help some other people. And I just didn't really have a clear thought on it. And so I started looking at what the Bible actually says about debt. And I'm going to tell you, I was surprised. I thought it leaned one way more, but actually after looking at the Bible, I can't say I've changed my mind exactly, but I've gone in a direction that's a little different. And I feel more confident about that because of what the Bible says, what the Bible says, but also what it doesn't say. So the first thing I want to do is to talk about groups that teach that borrowing is wrong or sinful. Some groups have like traditionally taught that borrowing is just straight up a sin. And they use the very same verses that I'm going to talk about today. So we'll talk about the verses in a minute, but like they use the same verses. So I'm not going to get into why they're saying that, but I'll just give you some examples. Some of the Anabaptist groups that, like Amish and the Old Order Mennonites, taught that. I guess you maybe you'd call those traditional Anabaptists in a sense. Many evangelicals descend theologically from Anabaptists, but I don't need to get into that. But some of those groups taught that it was just explicitly a sin. Some of the holiness and the, Pentecostal groups, but not all of them. So certain holiness groups taught that it was a sin, straight up a sin. But not all of them. And I don't have a list of what those would be, but, it was a teaching in those circles. Christian Reconstructionist. I just have this on a list here and I'm not precisely clear on what this is, but Christian Reconstructionists, theonomy leaning teachers, some, but not all. If that means some to you, great. It doesn't really mean anything to me. And then some independent fundamentalist preachers, teach that it is a lack of faith and that it's a sin to borrow. And that is a particular thing that I feel like I have heard in conversations, not so much in the recent one with the guys that I'm buddies with, but in previous, like growing up, I remember hearing talks about debt and that it was kind of like a lack of faith. Okay. So those are groups that teach that it was a sin. It's just a straight up sin. Here's some that you might have heard of that teach, they don't teach that it's a sin, but they strongly advise against it. Dave Ramsey, he will say that debt is dangerous. It can be a curse. It can be unwise. And he pretty strongly advises avoiding debt, but he makes an exception for a house mortgage. So he's not against debt completely. He's against unwise debt, I probably would say. And I think he feels, some of you guys that know Dave Ramsey better could probably, fill this out. But, from what I understand, he sees a mortgage as really basically the only kind of wise debt. And everything else ought to be, I don't know, cash, paid for. But I'm no expert on Dave Ramsey, but I think that, you know, and I think also Dave Ramsey is not so focused on what is a sin or not a sin. He's just trying to help people who have actually fallen into debt. So his, one of his main things, it seems to me, is trying to help people who have a problem with debt, you know. So that's a thing. Another Bill Gothard Institute in Basic Life Principles. He didn't teach apparently. I wasn't real familiar with what he did, but we did have in the church where I grew up, we had people that followed his curriculum and stuff. Gothard never called borrowing a sin in a technical sense, but the way that he talked about it kind of put, well, it put a stank on it, you know. He basically taught that borrowing places a person under a bondage, and this was big for him. If you followed the Gothard thing, did you ever see that, that diagram they had of the umbrella of protection, or I can't remember what it's called, but I'm visualizing an umbrella. And I think that had more to do with the family structure. And that was like, there's like this umbrella of protection and it comes from God and then it's in the family. Well, some of his teaching taught that going into debt would forfeit God's protection. That's a big statement. If you think about that, like he's saying that if you take out a loan, God won't protect you in some particular way. I don't have notes on exactly what he was getting at, but that's a really big statement. And that's the kind of statement that you need a verse in the Bible to back that up. And then he also went with the borrowing demonstrates a lack of faith. That too is a strong enough statement in my mind that like you need a verse to back that up if you're going to go that route. So he would say maybe he would say it's not necessarily a sin, but Christians shouldn't do it. You know, he was telling people not to do it, basically. And he would quote Romans 13:8, which in some translations says that you should owe no man anything. However, it's not all that difficult to look at different translations and actually see a different sense of that verse, which we'll get into in a minute. But so that's Gothard. So Gothard was hugely influential. And so so that's a big one. Another ministry that you might think of like Dave Ramsey's was the wrestler on, Nacho Libre. Dave Ramsey. Another like financial ministry is called Crown Financial Ministry, Larry Burkett and Ron Blue. Now I don't follow these guys. This just comes on this list that I've put together. They teach debt is not a sin, but they would say something like it's a spiritual disadvantage. It reduces Christian freedom and ability to give. Now, those I actually would agree with, I think. Spiritual disadvantage, no, I don't think I'd agree with that. Reduces a Christian's freedom and ability to give, maybe. That's pretty broad. That's like a blanket. I'm not sure about that. It could. Nah, I don't know. I mean, There are exceptions to that, but excessive debt. See, and I think in a lot of these cases, what is really being talked about is excessive, unwise debt. Apparently certain Puritan influenced evangelical groups. What do we mean by that? Let's see. Many Puritans taught that borrowing wasn't sinful, but was nearly always foolish. You may not be sinning, but you a fool. Some modern reform voices echo this. Not sinful, but often foolish. And basically should just avoid consumer debt. And then this list says many mainstream evangelical churches teach that borrowing isn't sinful, but warn strongly about materialism, high interest credit, living beyond means. Well, yeah, all of those, obviously. You know, so I would agree with all those. Materialism is a problem. High interest credit is a problem. Living beyond means is a problem. I would put in that high interest credit category, these payday loan places that you get usually in a certain part of town. You know what I'm talking about? Like where they're giving these loans, but the terms are insane. You know, the interest rate is, you know, they can't even fit it in the building. It's so through the roof, you know. So clearly there's wisdom to be had here. So here's what I get scared about is when we take wisdom and we turn it into kind of a rule. And I feel like that's tempting because we know that not everybody is going to act wisely, right? Not everybody's going to act wisely. And so it's easier just to say, well, don't do it, everybody. But for some people, they are financial geniuses and they have a lot of self-control and they can make it happen, you know, and they can make it work. And so the question then becomes, well, does the Bible allow for it? And we'll get to that right after I drink another sip of coffee and tell you a story. It just occurred to me, if I had anybody that wanted to advertise on this show, I could put their commercials in my coffee drink break. It would be like a 3-second commercial. Okay, so years ago, I had a friend named Grant Conaway. Grant Conaway, I highly doubt you're listening to this podcast, but if you are, I want to tell people about a conversation we had. We were at Chick-fil-A, and Grant Conaway was some kind of financial, I don't remember exactly, but maybe he was working in financial services or something. And he talked to me. We were just meeting as buddies. We were just buddies, but he was telling me about how it's financially advantageous. It's an advantage. If you have a credit card that does like cash back, that if you put all of your purchases on that credit card and then pay it off by the end of the month, before the interest hits and then you receive the cash back, then you actually wind up financially ahead and you can actually make money by using that system. And I was like, wow. Okay, so credit card, you know, pay it off into the month, no problem. I think I could do that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I went and got a credit card after that from my bank. I just thought, well, I'll get one from my bank that, you know, integrates into my bank account. So I got this credit card and I started doing it and, I think it worked for a little while. But then somehow I failed to pay it off by the end of the month. I don't know. I was not making much money at the time. And here's maybe the lesson is like, if you're not making much money, stay away from credit cards. Holy cow. Cause boy, that'll make a mess of things. But I was not making much money. And, so I had this credit card thinking that it was going to give me a financial advantage. And what actually wound up happening was I got way behind. I got behind by like $4,000, I think. But what I mean by behind, I mean, I owed $4,000 on the credit card and I was just paying the minimum because I didn't really look too closely at the terms. You know, it was just like, well, you know, they let me use it and whatever. So I got thousands of dollars in and I know 4,000 isn't like some people's huge debt, but it's something, you know, and at the time, 4,000 compared to my income was like super insane. There's just like, there's no way I'm going to, you know, I mean, I was making like 250 bucks a week at the church I was working at. And that was my only job, you know, that's like $1,000 a month. So I was making $1,000 a month and I had $4,000 in debt. So you get the idea. So, later on, so I just carried that debt for a long time and it kept accruing and it kept getting bigger and I don't know how big it got. It got to, you know, larger. And so when I got engaged to my wife, Krista, I told her as a wedding present, I'm going to pay this debt down before we get married because I don't want to go into marriage with this debt, you know, and I did. And by then I had enough money to do it and I had just let it sit. And that's the scary thing is like by then I could have just paid it down because I had a working business, you know, but for whatever reason, I was like, well, I just don't want to. It's not fun. It's not fun to pay it down. So that was extremely unwise. It wasn't unwise for Grant Conaway because he was self-disciplined and could make it work. It was unwise for me. And I don't know, I guess maybe I had to do it to learn that that's where my limits are. It was unwise for me. So once we paid it down, actually before we paid it down, I cut those credit cards up. I'm like, I don't want to ever touch this thing again, you know? And so I just had like a no credit card policy. I haven't had a no credit policy. But I have had a no credit card policy, and generally I've had a no debt from anyone except family members policy. I have received, actually the only loans I've ever received were from family members. And that's been a decent situation, but that works for us because I'm, you know, I have the fortitude, I guess, to stick with those payments. And so I pay those. So now I want to jump into what does the Bible actually say about debt? And this surprised me because I wonder if maybe it was Gothard influence at the church where I grew up. I don't know, but I had a different idea from what I actually found in the Bible over the last couple of days. So there are a number of verses about loaning. And I'm trying to decide how to do this. I think what I want to do is I want to read you what my conclusions are. Then I want to read you the verses, and I'm just going to read them in their entirety. And then I will highlight certain conclusions as I read those verses. Okay, so the first thing is in the Old Testament, I wanted to kind of get my arms around what does the Old Testament have to say about debt and loaning and lending and borrowing, you know, stuff like that. So this is Deuteronomy 15, 8 through 10. So this is early on. This is like as the nation of Israel, we might even say the spiritual nation of Israel, is being developed and kind of put into place. God is giving them instructions on how they ought to operate, both with each other and with others. And so here's what he says in Deuteronomy 15, 8 through 10. He says, but you shall open your hand to him. This is talking about the poor. So other Israelites who are poor, you shall open your hand to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his needs, whatever he needs. Beware lest there be a wicked thought in your heart saying the seventh year, the year of release is at hand. The seventh year was the sabbatical year, and that was a year when debts would be forgiven. And so this is for sure talking about a debt. And it is instructing Israelites to willingly lend to one another. Okay. And he doesn't just say it's an option. He says that a wicked thought in your heart would be to not lend because you know that it's going to be forgiven. Okay. So that is an interesting angle. He's saying that you should lend even if you're going to lend at a loss, but it is still lending. So it is generally accepted that it would be paid back. What would usually happen is people would lend what they were pretty sure they could get back. But he's saying, no, go beyond that. But it is still an instruction for lending. The seventh year, and your eye be evil against your poor brother. So it's talking about poor brothers. And you give him nothing, and he cry out to the Lord against you, and it becomes sin among you. So some have said it's sin to lend and borrow. Here in Deuteronomy, it's actually saying it can be a sin not to lend. That if you are stingy and you decide not to lend to somebody because you're not sure they can pay it back, that actually would be a sin because God's instructing them to lend to each other even when sometimes a person might struggle to pay it back. Now, the expectation is still that they pay it back, but sometimes, you know, so here's the term I'm sort of coining for this. I would call this loving lending. So So God knows that in our fallen sin nature, we would lend and take advantage of each other in a way that isn't good. And so he's saying, yes, lend, but there needs to be limits and you need to be willing to take a loss. If it doesn't work out, it would be sin to not help those who are in need. So we're talking here about needy people, those in need, taking a loan, and it would be sin to not help them with a loan. And then notice what he says after that. He says, because for this thing, the Lord your God will bless you in all your works and in all to which you put your hand. So he's saying, if you don't lend to those who are in need, lovingly lend to those who are in need, then you're not going to get a blessing, but you'll get a blessing if you are generous enough to lend to each other. Now notice, he does imply that you should lend even if it's possible you'll lose your investment, but he doesn't tell them to just give it to them. I mean, he could have said that. He could have said give to the poor, but he's saying, no, make it a loan. Because then a loan, I guess we could extrapolate, a loan is better for the person in some particular ways because it encourages them to continue to work and to not just draw on the, not to take advantage of generosity. So here's what I'm seeing here. I'm seeing Israel was commanded to lend to each other, to lovingly lend to each other. Loving lending comes with a promise of blessing. Okay, so that's my first point, is that not only is it permissible, but for Israel at least, they were commanded to. They were commanded to lend to those who were in need, and it came with a blessing. Okay, so here's Exodus 22:25. If you lend money to any of my people who are poor among you, you shall not be like money lenders to him. You shall not charge him interest. Now, I know there are debates about this. That sometimes that last word is translated usury. And there's some opinions that usury is just taking advantage of the poor, but charging a little interest is okay. I actually don't think that's what's being said here, because the early rabbinic interpretation of this, like the rabbis, we have really old documents of what they thought it meant, and they just thought it meant interest. And so there's quite a few translations of the Bible that just render it interest, and they don't use that word usury. And I think that's just simpler, because he says, if you lend money to any of my people, to the poor among you, you shall not be like the money lender to him. You shall not charge him interest. Because the money lender is charging interest. The money lender is not necessarily taking advantage of them, above and beyond what is allowed. He's just charging interest. So for Jew to Jew loans, they were to be interest free. So they were commanded to lend, but they were commanded to not lend with interest to fellow Jews. However, notice what it says in Deuteronomy 23:20. He says, to a foreigner, you may charge interest, but to your brother, you shall not charge interest, that the Lord your God may bless you in all to which you set your hand in the land which you are entering and possess. So once again, it talks about lending money comes with a blessing. It's actually a blessing to lend money. And that the implication is because you are blessing the person who is in need. So in this case, the blessing comes for not charging interest to fellow Jews. But it seems like he's saying that the blessing also is connected to being willing to loan to non-Jews, and you can charge interest for that. So lending and therefore borrowing is okay. It's permissible. It's something that is allowed, that we're allowed to do. Now here's a really interesting one, just kind of a historical thing. Deuteronomy 15:1-2. He says, at the end of every 7 years, you must cancel debts. So this implies that there's going to be debts. People are accepting loans and it's okay. This is how it is to be done. Every creditor shall cancel any loan that they have made to a fellow Israelite. Now that is, so that's kind of interesting. So loans made to foreigners may, I guess they weren't canceled, but if you made one of those no interest loans to a fellow Israelite, it went away. You know, it just stopped at the end of 7 years. He says, they shall not require payment from anyone among their own people because the Lord's time for canceling debt has been proclaimed. So that means for up to 7 years, though, they were receiving payment for a loan. So basically, here's my points. Israel was commanded to lend to each other for those who were in need. Loving lending comes with a promise of blessing. Interest-based lending was for foreigners. Interest-free lending was for the Israelite community, and that loans were a normal part of Israel's economy because of the year of sabbatical. It talks about, like, you know, lots of people have loans. So getting a loan is acceptable, and loving lending comes with a promise of blessing from God. Now, this is just a different sense than I was hearing when I was a kid. From wherever our influence was from, it wasn't really presented this way. Like, this is okay. This is an okay thing to do. It's just kind of a given, that sort of an expectation that this is going to be happening. Now, this comes with a caveat, though. There is a type of debt-related behavior that is strongly discouraged. Coffee break. But this one surprised me too, because I thought I knew what it meant, but I looked closer at the actual verses, and there is a, there's a detail in these that I didn't catch before. I hear a vacuum cleaner going in the office here. I might pause for a second and come back to you here in just a second. Okay, they've stopped vacuuming. I guess I like that they vacuum, but it was a little inconvenient there. Okay, so here's the big surprise. Here's the big reveal. I think people that have looked at this have noticed that Proverbs especially speaks very strongly against co-signing. So in biblical terms, that's sometimes called surety. We call it co-signing. What it means is, let's say that I wanted to borrow $10,000 from the bank, but my credit's no good. You know, I've got no credit history or whatever. So I could find somebody to go to the bank with me, and I would sign the loan, but they would sign the loan too. And what it means is, if I default on the loan, if I can't pay it, then that other person, because they signed their name, they have to pay it. I thought that that was wrong. I thought that Proverbs was telling us that we should not do that. However, I'm now convinced it's not quite so straightforward. So, Proverbs, this is my paragraph I wrote on it. Proverbs issues its strongest financial warnings about guaranteeing a stranger's loan. And that's called surety or co-signing. A stranger's loan. Sometimes it calls it a neighbor, but a stranger's loan. And then it also mentions that it's not good to take out a loan when you don't have the means to cover the cost. But it's also, in that case, talking about co-signing for that loan with a stranger. And so this is a new angle for me that I hadn't really noticed before. So co-signing with a stranger is not the same as accepting or giving a loan. That's an extra layer of just idiocy. Who would co-sign with a stranger, you know? Note that these verses don't even forbid co-signing in a standard form. They don't even forbid co-signing for a loved one when you have the assets to pay it off. They strongly caution against co-signing with a stranger, sometimes called a neighbor too. The focus basically is, these verses in Proverbs are trying to help us not fall into the trap of basically a con man. Because if a stranger shows up and wants you to co-sign for something, don't fall for it. That's ridiculous. Okay, so I want to read the verses now. So, here's the first one. And this is the lengthiest one, but it's important to read first, I think, because you'll notice that it uses the word stranger and neighbor interchangeably. He says, my son, if you have put up security for your neighbor, security there means you've co-signed for a loan. If you've put up security for your neighbor, if you have shaken hands and pledged for a stranger, so the stranger there, he's using that word neighbor and stranger interchangeably. You have been trapped by what you said, enslaved by the words of your mouth. So do this, my son, to free yourself, since you have fallen into your neighbor's hands, go to the point of exhaustion, give your neighbor no rest, allow no sleep to your eyes, no slumber to your eyelids, free yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, like a bird from the snare of the fowler. So here, it's a couple of interesting things. First of all, he uses stranger, neighbor, and hunter interchangeably. I mean, basically, he's talking about a con man, somebody that tricked you into co-signing, and you didn't know what you were getting yourself into. And apparently, you don't know him well because it calls him a stranger. Okay, so don't co-sign with a stranger, but basically, anybody would say, yeah, that's a bad idea. Even without Proverbs, like, yeah, that's a bad idea. Here's another one. Take the garment of one who puts up security for a stranger. Hold it in pledge if it is done for an outsider. So here you have stranger and outsider. This is just suggestion. He's saying if someone basically promises you to repay a loan that you've given him, you might want to take some security if you don't know him well. But that implies if you know him well, you don't necessarily have to take security. And hold it in pledge if it's done for an outsider. Outsider meaning someone outside of the nation, you know, someone that's not Jewish. So again, it's security for a stranger. Take the garment of one who puts up security for a stranger. Oh, that's like the same. It's basically restating it. This is 2016. Hold it in pledge if he's done for an outsider. That's like almost the exact same wording. So Proverbs 17:18, one who has no sense shakes hands in pledge and puts up security for a neighbor. So you have no sense if you do that. And again, neighbor and stranger, Proverbs sometimes uses interchangeably. Whoever puts up security for a stranger will surely suffer, but whoever refuses to shake hands and pledge is safe. So that's Proverbs 11:15. So what we're gathering here is, I was told as a young man that co-signing is unbiblical, but that's what I just read is all of the verses on co-signing. As far as I can tell, that's all of the verses. And what they all have in common is this stranger or neighbor idea. So I began to think, well, what about like a dad who wants to help his son buy his first car? The dad has the assets to pay for the car if things go south. And because he loves his son and he's willing to pay for it if it doesn't go well, he co-signs. From what I'm seeing in Proverbs, I think that is actually plenty acceptable. So I've changed my mind on this. I used to think co-signing was just bad, that you're just not supposed to co-sign. I've shifted a bit. If you have the financial means to cover it and you are willing to cover it, and especially if it's someone that you know and you care about and you're fairly confident that they're going to pay it off, but you're willing to take care of it if they don't, I think this is saying you can enter into that as long as you enter in with your eyes open, you know what you're getting into. And so even the co-signing with a stranger, it's like if you're a millionaire and you co-sign with a stranger for a small loan that you can pay off, it's like, yeah, whatever. It's not wise, but It doesn't specifically say that's a sin. It just suggests against it. But the other thing, you know, the co-signing for something you can cover if you need to, and for someone you love or someone you know well, or just somebody you want to help out. The point is, make sure you know what you're getting into. And if you think back to the year of sabbatical where the loan would be forgiven, what he's saying is you ought to loan to people even if the loan is going to be forgiven in a year or two. And don't be stingy. So in this case, you could take this co-signing for a stranger. If you see somebody that needs help and you can co-sign with them and you can actually pay for it, and you're willing to, then that's a different situation than being taken in by a con man, you know. So Proverbs warns about taking on debt when you don't have the means to pay it. And that's another factor altogether. It's different than taking on debt when you are financially able to afford it. So here's Proverbs 22, 26, and 27. It says, "Do not be one who shakes hands in pledge or puts up security for debts if you lack the means to pay. Your very bed will be snatched from under you." But notice what he just said. He just said it's a conditional statement. So the opposite of that would be, it would be okay to shake hands and pledge or put up security for debts if you have the means to pay. I mean, that's what the implication is. So this verse really kind of helps us understand all the others that are talking about co-signing and everything else. Is like, if you have the means and you're willing to, you know, put up security, basically that's collateral. You know, like I'll stake my house on this loan or whatever. So if you have the means, if you can stomach the loss, then you're free to do it, you know, as long as you know what you're getting into. But notice what he says, if you lack the means to pay, your very bed will be snatched from under you. He's saying like, don't do it he's saying don't be unwise, you know. But that concludes all. No, I'm sorry. There's one more Proverbs. I was about to say that's all of what's in Proverbs. There's one more in Proverbs. And this one is a little different. So I'll read it first and then I'll kind of explain what I think about this. The rich rule over the poor and the borrower is slave to the lender. Now I suspect this one is used a lot. Like when Gothard or when, oh gosh, what was the other one? So another one that kind of talked about, debt takes away your spiritual freedom. And puts you in bondage. It definitely can, metaphorically, in our economy today. But in the ancient world, it literally would do that. Like in the ancient Near East, where this was being written, unpaid debts resulted in imprisonment, slavery, or even death. And I'm not just talking about slavery of the one who owes. It was very common for someone to get into debt. And then part of the situation was to pay off their debts, they were forced to sell their children into slavery. And the reason why they could force them to sell their children into slavery is because they themselves were also sold into slavery. And so it was a brutal situation. You could be imprisoned. You could be tortured. You could be put to death for debt. So debt was serious. Debt was life and death, you know. So that gives a different sense of the rich rule over the poor and the borrower is slave to the lender. So this is a cautionary tale. He is cautioning against taking debt that you cannot handle, debt that is beyond your means to pay off. But there's another angle to it. And the other angle to it is that modern society, in the West at least, in the United States, I'll speak for the United States, I don't know about other places, but I think this is pretty true in most Western countries, there are modern financial protections that basically fulfill Proverbs' wisdom with the exception of cosine, and you can definitely cosine with a stranger. But with that exception, in Proverbs, you know, borrowing carried this physical danger. Your family could be sold into slavery, you could be imprisoned, you could be tortured, put to death. But in modern America, the very protections, this is what I wrote, the very protections Proverbs 22:7 warns borrowers to seek, they're built into our legal and financial system because we are a, you may have heard this term, we're a non-debtor prison society. You can't put people in, you can't put people in prison for their financial debt. You can put people in prison for a lot of things, but not for their financial debt. You cannot enslave people for debt. You can garner their wages, but you can't take away someone's freedom in the United States for their debt. We also have financial protections like bankruptcy, limited liability laws, and lending regulations that exist to protect the borrower from exorbitant or unusual aspects that will get them into, you know, all kinds of trouble. So borrowing within reasonable limits, it actually aligns with the safeguards Proverbs encourages. So we are incredibly protected compared to the society in which Proverbs was written. Now, that doesn't mean that Proverbs' wisdom should be ignored. We still need wisdom in our daily life, and we need wisdom in how we deal with our money. But where it was literally true that the borrower was the slave of the lender when Proverbs 22:7 was written, it is no longer literally true. It is metaphorically true. But it was literally true when that was written. And so that doesn't mean that we don't gather something from this verse, but I think it means we need to be very careful in saying that this verse means we shouldn't take out loans because we are incredibly protected. You are not the slave of your lender. If you have a loan, you are obligated to, you're obligated to pay that to some extent. But the consequences are very different than they used to be. And here's the thing. You can get out of debt. You can file bankruptcy. You can give the asset back. You can let it go into foreclosure. I mean, there are lots of things that you can do that you can move away from a debt. Obviously, you can work to pay it off, but there's these other protections. So this does not mean, however, that borrowing beyond our means is biblical. It doesn't mean that. It just means that the dangers that it talks about are different. They're different today. So if you go to a bookie, let's say that you go to a, an illegal bookie and you bet, well, I guess that's gambling, so maybe that's different. If you borrow from the mafia, I don't know anything about the mafia. I don't know, but I see movies. If you borrow from the mafia or some independent third party, you are in danger. You're very much in danger. So that's not within biblical wisdom. I don't want to cut into their business or anything, but don't do that. That's not good. But if you borrow within your means, and within a protected system like the United States regulated financial system, then it's my opinion that you are well within the wisdom that you see in Proverbs. And I think Solomon, who wrote much of Proverbs, would look at our system and say, oh yeah, that's not what I was talking about. I was talking about this other thing, you know, co-signing for strangers when you don't have enough assets to even cover your bed. You know, that you're that poor and you're co-signing for strangers. It's just crazy. So that concludes the Old Testament content that I could find. Now, maybe you guys can think of some other things, but like that's all I could find on the Old Testament. So you may be gathering that my opinion on the Old Testament is not only that it's permissible, but in some cases it was actually commanded to lend, and that borrowing and lending is is just, it's embedded in the foundation of Israel. You know, it was just part of what was expected. So now I want to jump to the New Testament, and if I'm being honest, there's just not much, but there are a couple of notes. Now, you'll remember, let me double check that list again. You'll remember that I mentioned that the Gothard approach, at least, was to quote Romans 13:8 against debt. And in certain translations, Romans 13:8 says that it says owing no man anything. And he apparently, now I didn't sit under Gothard's teaching, but we did have some influence from him. The idea is that you're not supposed to owe anybody anything because it kind of puts you in bondage. It takes you outside of God's protection and et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know where he was going with all that, but it's not real hard to see that that's not exactly what that verse is saying when you look at it in like NIV, which is a very respected translation. Actually, there's a number of translations that do it this way, but look at what the NIV says. It said, oh, and also, if you don't just quote that one verse, which is 8, if you look at 7 as well, you get a better context. So notice what it says. It says, give to everyone what you owe them. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. Let no debt remain outstanding. Now that line's different in other translations. Some translations say, owing no man anything. And if you only quote that in that particular translation, yes, you can make an argument that it sounds like he's saying you shouldn't have any debt. But think about this translation and the context. He's saying that I know you're going to owe taxes at least. And those of you that are businessmen, I know you're going to at least owe revenue, which is basically debt. What it is like your workers, you know, revenue would be your workers, have worked and you haven't paid them yet. You owe them wages. Some translations render that actually customs. So I don't know what to make of that, but just, it's still business related. So there are debts. There's just, you're going to owe something. At some point, you're going to owe some money. And so I really like what NIV does with it. He says, let no debt remain outstanding. He's not saying don't have debt at all. He's saying be good for your word. And if you say you're going to pay a debt on time every month, then pay it. Don't let that be outstanding. I think what he's getting at is like, you have freedom in Christ, you've been given grace, but that grace doesn't extend to your banker. They still are going to expect to be paid for what you said you'd pay them. So live up to your word and, you know, and pay your debts, pay it down, you know. So let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another, for whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. Really beautiful. Romans 13:7-8. So this sort of like death nail verse that Gothard and maybe others would use, it's not so clear. I mean, I can see why certain translations, if you chop out the context and you use a certain translation, how it could look like it's saying that debt is not allowed, but it's just not, that's just, I mean, in my opinion, it's just not what it's saying. So I don't think that's what it's getting at. So here's the paragraph I wrote. In the context, it's obvious that Paul knows people will owe various tax debts and revenue debts. He isn't saying you have to avoid debts. His point is not to leave anything you owe. His point is don't leave anything you owe unpaid. The NIV above makes it much clearer than other translations. Let no debt remain outstanding. Implies that we will accept reasonable debts and we are obligated to pay them. So that does not mean that we have the wisdom permission, the unwise permission to borrow way outside of our means, to borrow for things we don't, you know, that aren't close to essential or needed or, you know, things that we know we can pay down. It doesn't give us permission for that, but it does acknowledge that, yeah, you're going to owe things. Now here's another one that occurred to me. And this is my final little segment. The teachings of Jesus normalize lending and borrowing. They sort of assume, and actually, I'll just read it. Matthew 25:27. This is like at the end of the parable of the talents. You remember that one where, you know, he gives money to, now that I think about it, it makes the nobleman a lender. He gives money to his servants and they are supposed to do something with the money that makes him more money. What is that? Well, doggone, he's a banker or something. I mean, it's more than that. He was like a nobleman, but basically he's a lender. He lends the money to them and then it still belongs to the nobleman, but he expects a return on investment. So he's investing it and he invests it in these small businessmen, basically. And they're expected to go out and do business, you know, start a business and make some money. And then the nobleman goes away and he comes back. This is true of both the parable of the minas and the parable of the talents. The nobleman goes away, he comes back and he checks in on his servants and some of his servants have done really well. How have they done well? Well, in the money that the nobleman has lent them, they've, you know, that investment, I don't know if it's lending or it's investing. I don't know if there's a difference. Maybe there is, but they get a return. But then the unfaithful servant, the lazy servant, what the nobleman says to him is that like the bare minimum was that they should have taken it to the money lenders and put it on loan so that it could make at least a little bit of interest. And so for the least successful, his suggestion actually is you should have become a money lender. You know, you should have gone out and you should have made money with my money by lending, by giving a loan, you know, by allowing your money to be used in a loan. And so that's just interesting that in Jesus's story, the bare minimum moving toward the ideal is to lend money, is to be a lender, you know? So it doesn't seem like Jesus was against money lending. And that's not the only of his stories that had to do with lending. The Matthew 18:23-35, that's the parable of the unforgiving servant. Remember, that's the one where a big debt is owed to, like, I don't know if it's a king or a nobleman, but it's forgiven, forgives the debt. And then the one who owed that debt was actually owed a smaller debt and he goes out and starts choking the guy that owes him and says, pay it off now. And so the nobleman hears about it and he reinstates his loan. He unforgives his loan. He says, oh, okay, you're going to be like that. Well, then I'm going to reinstate the loan and you got to pay it off completely. And he tortures him. And here's the thing that, like, in that story, the hero of the story who represents God is a money lender. And so I mean, what I'm saying is Jesus represents God as a money lender, and the victim and the unfair sublender are both borrowers. And so both the good guys and the bad guys were borrowing and lending money. So what am I saying? I think what I'm saying is it's okay. It's expected. It's normalized. You know, here's the other thing. If you have a savings account, you're a lender. You know, you have put your money into a bank so that it could be lent out. That's how a bank works. So that it could be lent out at interest and you get some of that interest. The bank keeps some of that interest because they're managing it. If you put money in the stock market, this didn't exist in biblical times, but it's a very similar thing. You're putting money into someone else's business, basically, I guess you could say, and you get interest back. It's not interest exactly. It's what do you call that? Is it dividend or something? Anyway, I think my bottom line is just that going into this, I had a few old conceptions of what I thought the Bible said about lending and loaning and borrowing. But basically I've become even more convinced that it's not only okay, but it's just part of the expected shape of society. It's just part of it. It does come with caution, though. I think it's fair to say that in Scripture, the biggest warning is not actually against accepting loans. It's against giving unfair loans. It's instructions to be a loving lender. But it does, it, as far as I can tell, I can't find any place that it tells, okay, so like think about those ones in Deuteronomy. They don't say that the poor person who accepts a loan is a fool. You know, what they actually imply is there are going to be people who are needy and they just are going to need a loan sometimes. And they're not shamed for needing a loan. They're not told they're doing something bad. They're not told, okay, so let me go to this one. They're not told that it's a lack of faith. And I do feel like I do hear this in this conversation is like, well, we just want to trust God. You know, like we just want to trust God. And what that implies is the person who takes a loan isn't trusting God. But that's misreading Deuteronomy. Because it's God that said to those who are wealthy, lend to those who are poor in a loving way. So God's provision in Deuteronomy is that they accept a loan from somebody who has the means to loan to them. So it's a misnomer. And I guess, you know, it seemed like that was part of that Gothard thing too. Let's see, I've got it here. Let me look. Okay, the three things I have on Gothard is, yeah, he would teach that borrowing demonstrates a lack of faith. That's bogus. Think about Deuteronomy. That's bogus because those in Deuteronomy, the poor who would accept a loan in Deuteronomy, they were accepting God's generosity through the wealthy who God had told the wealthy to take care of them. So it's not a lack of faith. That just doesn't work. The other one is going into debt forfeits God's protection. Again, the protection that God is offering for Israel, at least, are these loans. Now they are loans that would be forgiven every 7 years, but they'd be expected to pay back until the year of sabbatical. And so God's protection is the loan. This is the insanity of this thing. I'm actually really kind of surprised, that this was a teaching that he was promoting. Places a person under bondage. This is one that I get that one. I understand what he's saying there. Yeah. I mean, It can, but if you're poor and you're going to starve to death, because that's who we're talking about, right? Is people who were going to starve to death, people who didn't have the means, then, you know, they accepted the bondage. So anyway, it's permissible. And I feel like we've got some bad teachings that have kind of floated into our thinking that have to do with faith. And I feel like part of this idea that it's a lack of faith is, well, what exactly would the alternative be? The alternative would be something maybe more mystical where you say, well, I'm just going to trust God and the money will magically show up. Well, how does it magically show up? Without exception, it shows up through somebody if it does. Right? I mean, I guess maybe there was a time when I was a kid when we found a $20 bill in the front yard. And, I remember somebody saying when we said that, somebody said, oh, God's providing for you. And I thought, well, I guess by providing for us, he's taking from someone else, you know. I just was like, you know, so yeah, sometimes you can accidentally find change in the couch. But by and large, when you say, I'm going to trust God for finances, what you mean is you're going to trust that somebody is going to help you out. And it might be a believer or unbeliever one way or another, but it is going to come through people. And so borrowing is part of the biblical framework for people being helped out that don't have the means to cover what they, you know, what they have. Oh, that was a lot. Man, how long have I been going? Goodness, like 45 minutes or something. So, any case, I feel like debt is okay within your means. And if you avoid the foolish kind of things that, you know, that we've talked about here. So I think I'm going to cap it at that. I know this was kind of a different sort of ramble. It wasn't much of a ramble, actually. It's kind of more of a teaching. But I wanted to get it all down. I wanted to make it into something that we could just get, you know, my buddies could actually just listen through. Cause this is just what I'm thinking. I'm going to talk to them about it too, but I thought this might be easier to listen through this and just kind of get a feel for it. So my bottom line conclusion, obviously you can tell, is it looks to me like debt is okay as long as it's done within reason. And I don't see any specific difference mentioned for like the expectations of like a church, like how they do their finances, or a businessman, how he does his finances, or a family, how they do their finances. There doesn't seem to be any distinction here. It just seems like it's permissible. Is, you know, you need to be using wisdom and you need to be within your means, but as far as loans go, within your means doesn't mean that I have the cash socked away and I just want to borrow. It means that you're able to pay for the pay schedule, the agreed pay schedule. That would be what within your means would mean. Now, if you make $20,000 a year and you take out a loan for $500,000 for something, that's not within your means. In fact, the bank will recognize that that's not within your means. And here's the other thing. This goes along with those protections. The bank knows, I thought I was done, but here's another thing. If you're borrowing from a bank, like a reputable bank, now there are times like leading up to 2008 where this wasn't happening, but generally the bank wants to protect its assets, which in reality protects the borrower and the lender. Because there's so many laws to protect the borrower, the bank then will deny loans that are outside of someone's means. You know, they'll look at the pay stubs and they'll say, well, you can't pay for this, man, so we can't give you the loan. Or if it's really close, they'll say, you might be able to pay for it, but it's too close. It's not good for you. You know, and so yet again, borrowing outside your means, you can borrow at the edge of your means and it can be unwise. The regulations allow, the federal regulations for borrowing and lending really allow debt at a level that I think is outside your means, but maybe not so outside your means as the ancient world did. Cause it seems in the ancient world, you could get yourself so in debt that they would put you in prison and torture you, you know? Just a different system, just a different world. And so some of the things that the Bible cautions us against, just we're just protected from in our society today. It's not to say that society couldn't change and we could be really exposed, but, it just seems like really different. So, hey, I'm going to cap it at that. I really am done now. I really am done. Thanks for listening. And, hopefully this is helpful to some of you guys. Oh. See you later.